You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Moving right along. Gives me great pleasure to introduce an esteemed colleague and somebody who's written over 50 books, screenplays, who's an anthologist, a biographer, an editor, and a writer for radio. Am I leaving anything out?
No.
No, I'm not leaving anything out.
Historian, don't forget the comic books.
Oh, right, a historian, historian of popular culture. His story, let me see if I can get the title right. With the beautiful Boomer Boys and Little Old New Alabama. Is that right?
Close enough.
Yeah. Was made into an Oscar-nominated short film back in 1990, I believe. He wrote a Hugo-winning fanzine, Zero, which has been republished by Tachyon. He's a Tachyon author, but also an author with probably more publishers than we can count on two fingers or two hands. Without further ado, with great pleasure, let me introduce my friend Dick Lupoff.
T-shirts. Cynics will tell you that no good deed goes unpunished, but of course, the opposite is true. At least sometimes. I was walking down Van Ness Avenue in San Francisco with my ultra-married friends, Laura and Gordon Tompkins, when I saw an old woman in a wheelchair trying to cross the thoroughfare. Van Ness, in case you're unfamiliar with this city, is a wide street with a center divider. There are traffic lights, but a lot of drivers seem to think it fun to use Van Ness as a raceway, and scampering across is dangerous even for able-bodied pedestrians to attempt. And this old woman didn't even have one of those modern electric-powered chairs. She was pumping away with arms no thicker than sticks, and it looked as if she was likely to die of overexertion if some superannuated hot rodder in a monster SUV didn't first grind her into flinders. To add to the old woman's peril, it was early evening, just the time when visibility is worst. And it was starting to rain. I told Laura and Gordon, "I'll be right back." I ran after the old woman and grabbed the handles of her wheelchair, got her onto the island in the middle of Van Ness. I asked where she was going, and she gave an address nearby. As soon as I could get her across the rest of the avenue and to her home, I did. She looked up at me, and her eyes were not at all what I expected, not the rheumy, faded eyes of a feeble old woman. They looked young and bright and a color that I would call emerald green, except that description is totally inadequate. I asked if she needed help getting into the house, and she said no. Then she added, "You will be rewarded." And that was that. 5 minutes later, I was back with Laura and Gordon. "You know, you took a serious risk," Gordon said. "What?" Laura said, "This is a dangerous neighborhood. We're on the edge of the Tenderloin. That woman could have been a decoy working with muggers." I said, "Oh, I didn't think of that." Nobody said anything for a minute, so I said, "You see somebody needs help, you help her. It's not complicated." We stopped at the office of Rock, Rock, Rock to see if there were any messages, then on to the Civic Auditorium. Joe Cocker was performing that night. I run the West Coast office of RRR. Laura is a freelance photog who works for us now and then. Gordon is a software wizard who actually makes a living out of his job. Cocker was drunk. He threw up on stage and had to cancel the performance. The management had to refund the money of a couple thousand angry customers. Laura and I and Gordon paid a brief call to the backstage scene, snagged a couple of sandwiches and beers off the catering table, and worked the room. The usual groupies were milling around, looking more stoned and confused than ever. I spotted Vampirella. She was wearing her customary black satin outfit with opaque shades and blood-red costume jewelry. I tried to make the same approach I did every time I saw her, and she ignored me the way she did every time I tried. If you're wondering why I bothered, I can't give you an answer that makes much sense. She just had her hooks in me. Maybe it was her glossy sable hair, maybe it was her amazing complexion, or her slim, supple figure. I've never gone for the buxom type, but Vampirella, or whatever her real name was, could just crook her finger and I'd come running. Next day, I opened the RRR office and checked the day's mail, messages on the answering machine, LPs for review, and promotional loot. The rock business is brutally competitive, and the artists, promoters, and the record companies are constantly vying for airtime and ink for their precious darlings. People like me get invited to parties, offer generous doses of illegal candies, backstage passes, of course, trips to out-of-town conferences, and an endless array of coffee mugs, dinner trays, ballpoint pens, cheap wristwatches, T-shirts, giant belt buckles, and miscellaneous tchotchkes. I sat down to write as charitable a report as I could of last night's debacle. Laura would be in with some photos. I had no idea what she could have got that we could use, but she's a solid pro, and I knew she'd give me something good. I wrote the article and started through the day's loot, looking for something I could either use to hawk or for a few shekels. Mostly it was junk. I mean, Andy Kim? Up with people? What were the A&R geniuses smoking this month? There was a nice T-shirt, though. Black cotton with a nifty logo on the chest in white and the words Lone Star Beer in bright yellow lettering. I checked the label and it was my size. Winner. There was no promotional material with it. I couldn't think of anybody who'd put out an album called Lone Star Beer, but what the heck? It was a great shirt and it was a freebie. There was a show over in Berkeley that night and I wanted to catch it. Merle Saunders was playing at the New Monk, and based on past history, Jerry Garcia was likely to drop in and jam. I decided to inaugurate the Lone Star Beer shirt. Of course, it was chilly and wet, par for the course this time of year, so I bundled up. Merle was great, Nine Finger Jerry showed up and was amazing, and I wound up in the green room with them between sets. There was good wine and whiskey on the table, along with guacamole and chips. There were very few groupies. The bruiser at the door had seen to that. But I did spot Vampirella there. We made eye contact, and for the first time in recorded history, she smiled at me. I walked over, half expecting her to cut me dead. But instead, she offered me a tortilla chip slathered in green slime. Yow! Why the change? I was too happy to worry about that. I was just bathing in the divine presence. Jesus, she even smelled good. She said, "That's a great shirt. You from Texas? What's your name, cowboy?" I told her, "Del Marston, and I'm from Chicago." "Why the shirt?" "Just a nice shirt." We made small talk, called each other about trying to earn a living in San Francisco, drank some of the management's booze. Excellent. And headed out, along with Merle and Jerry, for the second set. When it was over, Vampy invited me up to her apartment for a nightcap. Believe that? Like a character in some old movie. Of course I said yes, and when we got there, she opened a bottle of Chardonnay and put on an LP. I wondered what her choice in music was going to be, hoping it wouldn't be too hard or loud, and she astonished me. Haydn. Next time I saw her was at the Sweetwater in Mill Valley. Maria Muldaur was singing. I'd put on a spiffy new shirt and jeans just in case, and all right, I spotted Vampirella. I didn't think Muldaur was her kind of music, but what the hell, boss, what the hell? I walked over and said, "Hi, remember me? Del Marston from Chicago?" She looked through me. We met at the New Monk, Merle Saunders and Jerry Garcia. She said, "I'm waiting for a friend," and turned away. What the heck? Moldauer was sweet, but I watched Vampirella all night, and her friend never showed up. And once the show ended, she disappeared before I could offer her a ride home. Jeez. Incidentally, I don't want you to think that my job is all hanging out at music venues, cadging catered meals in green rooms, drinking wine, and smoking dope with hippies. I have to do interviews and write concert and record reviews and keep this little office going. And I don't want you to think that I actually run Rock, Rock, Rock. I'm just the so-called West Coast editor. All my copy and all of Laura's photos wind up in New York, where the bigwigs put the magazine together. And I have to keep them happy to keep the checks flowing westward. Next show I wanted to cover was at the Pierce Street Annex, back in the city. Really talented folky named Paul Siebel, straight from Woodstock. It was a warm night for San Francisco, and I'd come home from the laundromat with some clean duds just in time to get dressed for Siebel's show. I put on my best safari boots, clean jeans, and my Lone Star Beer t-shirt. The shirt was plenty comfortable, and I was getting fond of it, although the dye the manufacturer used must have been pretty cheap because the shirt looked a little bit faded after only one washing. Well, the price was right anyhow. Siebel was even better in person than he was on his self-titled LP. A modest, sweet-natured guy, I introduced myself and told him I wanted to do a piece on him for RRR, and he acted as if I was some kind of celebrity. Coming out of the club after Siebel's show, who should I run into on Pierce Street but, right, Vampirella. I had a little tape recorder in one hand and my notebook in the other, and I was headed for my faithful bug. After the brush off I'd got at the Sweetwater, I didn't know what to expect of Vampy. But she came running at me and jumped into my arms, wrapped her legs around my waist, almost knocked the tape recorder out of my hands, planted a hot, wet one on my ear, and demanded, "Where have you been? Are you mad at me?" She said, "After the night we saw Jerry and Merle at the New York?" Once she climbed down from my midsection and I got back the breath she'd knocked out of me, I said, "I thought you were mad at me." She said, "How could I be mad at you? But then when I ran into you at the Moldauer show, I thought you must be totally pissed. Did I come on too strong at my place or what?" Now I was totally baffled. I figured all I could do was pretend the Sweetwater thing never happened. I said, "It's pretty late. Do you need a ride or what?" She said, "I'll tell you what. I'm really famished. You think we could rustle up some food? Mel's should be open." That would be okay, but do you know how to cook? Or I could make something if you have the ingredients. Well, long story short, for once the bug started without a fuss. I found a parking spot half a block from my modest digs, and we wound up having a bedtime snack of bacon and eggs and English muffins. A bachelor like me learns how to cook, at least the simple stuff. In the morning, she woke up first and returned the favor. And before she left, she invited me to go to a movie that night. And would you believe, I had a plus one press invite to exactly that flick. It was The Last Picture Show, and I am nuts for anything that Bogdanovich directs. Amazing. This was starting to look like a match made in heaven. As planned, I showed up at the theater half an hour before showtime. No sign of Vampy, but what the hell, it was early yet, and I knew she wanted to see the film. She'd even told me she had a crush on Timothy Bottoms. She wouldn't miss it. It was one of those chilly nights, a cold mist in the air and glowing nimbuses around street lamps and storefront neon. I wore a sweatshirt under a quilted jacket, and still I was freezing 10 minutes after I arrived. There was a coffee shop next door to the theater, so I headed in to get a hot cup. She was sitting in a booth with one of the Kerr twins. Oh, geez. You don't know the Kerr twins. Frankie and Jimmy. Frank Arthur Kerr and James Otho Kerr. I don't know what their parents were thinking of. Look at the initials. Their names turn into Faker and Joker. They both work for Scorpion Blues, my mag's meanest competitor. Every time I try for a plum interview, I have to worry about getting to the artist before Faker or Joker. Every time BBB loses an important ad, you can guess who got it. Scorpion Blues. Right. And there was Vampy, drinking latte and playing footsie with Frankie, or maybe Jimmy. I stood there, probably looking like a pimply high school nerd who just got dumped in favor of Super Jock and knows he's about to become the laughingstock of the junior class. Vampy displayed a butter-wouldn't-melt-in-her-mouth grin and waved to me and said, "Oh, hi there. Del, isn't it? Del Martin?" "Marston," I stammered, as if she didn't know. "You here for the last picture show?" Jimmy asked, "or maybe Frankie?" I ignored him. I said, "I thought we were going together, Vampirella. We just talked about it this morning, don't you remember?" "I'm sorry, Don." The sentence slithered from between her luscious lips like an aerial snake. "I don't know what you're talking about. Maybe you're thinking of somebody else." Jimmy, Frankie, slid his arm around her shoulders and said, "That rag of yours still going, Don? I don't hear much about it these days." I couldn't take any more. I went home and turned on Blue Oyster Cult loud and opened a bottle of cheap wine and got stinko. I played Don't Fear the Reaper a dozen times and sang along with Rosa and fantasized about Patti Smith. Next day, I enjoyed a hangover that would surely land me in the Guinness Book of World Records if I could figure out how to describe it to them. I excavated my favorite shirt out of the hamper and pulled it on. Either the shirt was getting ripe or I was, but I was in no shape to do anything about it. I peered into the mirror, and when I saw what was squinting back at me, I scrounged up a Commander Cody baseball cap that I got as a reward for a nice little article when the commander was just getting started. Money would have been nicer. I managed to crawl down to the office and write a couple of record reviews. I ripped into the material and the performances and the production and the cover art, and for all I know, I destroyed a dozen promising careers and sent as many sensitive artistic souls back to grad school for MBAs. Sorry about that. I drank a pot of coffee, wishing I was a private eye who kept a bottle of bourbon in his desk drawer to spike the Java with, but I wasn't and I didn't, and by mid-afternoon, I was feeling at least slightly human. There was a free show in Golden Gate Park, and the sun was shining. I left the bug in the driveway and struggled over to the park on foot. I heard the band tuning up from three blocks away. By the time I got there, Hot Tuna was launched into one of their patented all-day versions of Keep Your Lamps Trimmed and Burning. A haze of blue-gray stonedness was floating over the crowd. I struggled to a place near the stage and plopped my tuchus onto the grass and tried to get my head into the music. It was then that I heard the unmistakable sound of a female palm colliding with a male physiognomy and caught the wind of an angry exclamation that ended with, "And your pitiful little weenie too, you creep." That caught my attention. I turned in time to see Frankie Jimmy Kerr slinking away through the mob of stoned tuna lovers. And there was Vampirella decked out in black satin with opaque shades and her hair looking as if the sun had no other job than to make it look gorgeous. "Del," Vampy squealed. "Del, oh my gosh, I'm so happy to see you. You won't believe what that son of a something wanted me to do. Oh, Del, please, will you stay with me in case he comes back or sends that louse of a brother of his?" We stayed close together, and Hot Tuna went on and on. The sky grew dark, the crowd thinned, the stars came out, the gray mist embraced us, and we embraced each other, and I had an inkling for the first time in my life of what love poetry is about. And sometimes the world, as they say, is too much with us. I mean, the next day I scrubbed myself down, shampooed a couple of times, scraped the bristles off my face, threw everything except the sweatsuit on my back into a couple of pillowcases, and headed down to the local laundromat. I sat there reading a copy of The Dharma Bums while my clothes and the soap suds went round and round and round behind the little glass window. When the machine stopped, I transferred everything to a dryer and sat down again with my book, only to feel a cool and gentle kiss on my freshly shaven cheek. And there stood Laura Tompkins, ace girl shutterbug. "You're looking chipper as hell, boss. How's about buying a lady a cold, refreshing brew?" And off we went to a nearby watering hole. There was a jukebox in the corner, and somebody had fed it with a bunch of coins, and Grace Slick's voice was wailing. There was a TV set over the bar with the picture turned on and the sound turned off. In a totally bizarre way, Somebody to Love made a perfect soundtrack for Carl Malden and Michael Douglas screeching up and down the streets of San Francisco in their mile-long Ford sedan. And when Laura and I got back to the laundromat, some skunk had opened the dryer and made off with my personal wardrobe. I collared the dragon who made change and sold overpriced packages of soap powder to customers and demanded to know who had my belongings. She said it wasn't her job to play policeman, and couldn't I read? Didn't I see all the signs that said, "Keep an eye on your belongings. Management is not responsible for lost or stolen property." Jeez. Laura tried to cheer me up, invited me to join her and Gordon for a pizza and a movie, but I was in no mood. I just went home and sulked for the next several hours. When the walls started to close in on me and the only choice on TV was Lawrence Welk or Art Linkletter, I grabbed my Commander Cody baseball cap, at least I'd left that at home, and headed for North Beach. There's always some kind of distraction in North Beach. The flashing lights and pathetic barkers and moronic thrill seekers didn't do it for me, not tonight. They just depressed me. I walked down to City Lights and looked at the books at the window and decided maybe I'd find something to read. I wandered around picking books up and putting them down. I finally settled on a Coney Island of the mind. I stood in line to pay for the Ferlinghetti until I got to the cashier's counter. "All right, guess who was working the register?" I don't have to tell you. Oh boy, did she look good to me. "Vampirella!" "Yes, sir. You want that book?" "A great book. Great book. Excellent choice." She told me the price. It was right there on the cover, but she told me anyhow. "Vampirella, it's me, Dell." She told me the price again and held out her hand. I slapped the book into her hand and walked out. All right. All right. Why didn't I just write her off as a flake and go look for another lady fair? Well, try telling that to somebody who's so crazy in love. He can't figure out which way is up. For the next couple of weeks, I managed to avoid Vampirella. I started getting up early, showering and shaving regularly, working long hours, even freelancing to supplement the meager salary that the East Coast mobsters who owned Rock, Rock, Rock paid me whenever I called up and whined that I was starving. I got an invitation to a literary conference in Southern California. A library association had decided that the popular music press was worthy of a panel and offered me a cheap ticket on a PSA jet, a rental AMC Gremlin, and a room at the Motel 5 1/2 directly under the LAX flight path. Strangely enough, by the time my jet touched down, I had a hearty appetite, so I headed out in my Gremlin looking for a place to eat. I must have taken a wrong turn on the Hades Freeway because I wound up in an ugly town in the valley. When I tried to find my way back to L.A., I spotted an eating establishment with the unlikely name of Uncle Hoggly Woggly's Tyler, Texas Home Style Barbecue. There was a big sign over the door, a painting of a bright pink pig in a chef's hat, holding up a plate of barbecue and saying, "Bet you can't top this." Surrounded by the name of the establishment in glowing, incandescent letters. People were lined up to get into the joint, and the ones going in looked happy, and the ones coming out looked happier. So I figured this was a find. It was. If I ever get to Texas, God forbid, I will head straight to Tyler, wherever that may be, and wallow in barbecue until I can't stand it anymore. For now, though, I just feasted on ribs and sauce so hot it hurt, but so delicious I couldn't stop eating, and potato salad and coffee. That was all that Uncle Hoggly Woggly sold, and it was paradise now, as far as I was concerned. That was the high point of my trip. As for the low point, the conference was a nightmare. My panel was attended by about three bedraggled-looking spinster librarians. Turned out that everybody else was at a cocktail party in honor of the 100th birthday of a professor of medieval ballads from some local community college extension branch. The moderator of the panel must have been that professor's mother. She thought my magazine was a journal devoted to the study of petroglyphs. And my fellow panelists, there were two of them, were none other than my old buddies, Frankie and Jimmy Kerr, who, of course, proceeded to beat up on me verbally for 40 minutes while our moderator sat there, open-mouthed and horror-stricken. I spent the evening sitting on my bed at the Motel 5½, eating a stale chicken salad sandwich, drinking warm, flat beer, and watching the Brady Bunch in fuzzy black and white. I would have headed back to Uncle Hoggly Woggly's if I thought I could find it again, but the first time had been strictly a lucky strike, and I wasn't going to risk those freeways again. In the morning, I packed my minimal luggage, checked out of the Motel 5½, and started across the parking lot, looking for my avocado green gremlin. Other people were checking out. I saw a woman pushing a double-width stroller from the office. As she reached the middle of the parking lot, some kind of muscle car came screaming around the corner, headed straight for them. I don't think the driver expected anyone to be there, and he mashed on his brakes and the car started to skid, but there was no way it was going to stop in time, and no way that poor mother was going to get her little ones out of its trajectory. I want to emphasize, I'm no hero. I didn't decide that I was going to do what I did. I didn't even think about that when you see somebody who needs help business. I just, well, something clicked in my brain. And without thinking, I launched myself into a flying tackle, slammed into the woman with my shoulder, grabbed the handle of the stroller with my other hand, and yanked it after me. I hit the pavement hard with the woman in one hand and the stroller, complete with a pair of shrieking toddlers in the other. I was scraped all to hell and gone and bleeding in a bunch of places, but the mom and her tykes were untouched. The driver of the muscle car had stopped, and he and his passenger came trotting back to see what had happened. It was, all right, you got it, Frankie and Jimmy, and give them credit, lousy creeps that they are. They were concerned for the woman and her toddlers and remorseful for their carelessness and the tragedy that they had almost caused. And one of them even looked at me and said, oh, Del Marston, sorry about that. See you back up north. And they climbed back into their muscle car and went tearing out of the parking lot. The woman was hugging her toddlers and crying. After a little while, she stood up and held me, her hands on my arms. She actually cried into my jacket. Then she brushed off the cloth and said, oh, I got you all wet. In a minute, we both started laughing at the incongruity. She let go of me and leaned back and looked up at me. Her eyes were a color I'd only seen once before in my life. She said, so softly I could hardly hear, you will be rewarded. I got back to San Francisco without further incident. I was too pumped from the excitement to go home, so I opened the crummy little West Coast office of Rock, Rock, Rock and started through the usual accumulation of mail, LPs for review, press releases, invitations to music venues, and promo gifts. There was a Jiffy bag with no return address on it, but there was a Los Angeles postmark. I opened it and extracted a T-shirt. It was gorgeous. It featured a picture of a pig wearing a chef's hat, holding up a plate of barbecue, grinning and saying, "Bet you can't top this." Big, clear lettering around the artwork spelled out the name of the establishment, Dr. Hoggly Woggly's Tyler, Texas, Home Style Barbecue. That's all for folks.
Thank you, Dick.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.